Hello, and welcome to the Growth Mindset Podcast, your weekly dose of inspiration and exploration. Join me, your host, Sam Harris, as I discover how mindset can help you do incredible things through my conversations with the world's most interesting people, from tech billionaires to leading scientists, best-selling authors to notorious hackers. The goal is to increase our collective wisdom and attitudes to make us all happier and healthier, wiser and wealthier. Who doesn't want that? Today, I have Petra Volzavier on the podcast. Now, Petra is a pretty incredible character, to say the least. I was literally blown away by this conversation, and it was just so much more powerful than I was expecting. Petra is a mental health consultant and a therapist, and she also runs her own podcast, but she has a really crazy life history, and we dive into her upbringing in a religious cult and her problems with alcohol, addiction, and abuse. We also go into my own relationship problems and the world's problems at large. So we just have some huge advice on mental resilience, picking yourself up and finding good in bad situations. So it's just an awesome and inspiring interview. And I hope that you find something that connects with you as much as I did. And without further ado, please enjoy my interview with Petra. You're like a mental health coach. And so how did that all come about?
So I'm a mental health consultant. I guess it's a good catch-all phrase for like all the things that I do. But then within that, I'm a psychotherapist. So I've had one-to-one clients and a practice in the past. I'm an executive coach. So a lot of the coaching I do with high sort of CEOs or VPs or people right at the top, it's because they don't quite want to ask for a therapist. But they're like, I can see that you're a coach and that you have that background. So they come to me for topics like, you know, balance, relationship challenges, being into the, you know, their way of working really deeply, but they actually want to change and the stakes seem really high. So with that psychology background, but mostly I go into companies and I help them think about their mental health strategy from the human perspective. And that seems like it makes common sense maybe to me and you, but it's so interesting how much they can do a strategy, but not have any kind of human people well-being perspective in it. So yeah, and I do keynotes and I have a podcast. And as you know, I wear many different hats.
Okay, cool. So what are the sort of things that they actually really need help with? So when you go into a company, what's the normal kind of diagnosis that you come out with and be like, oh crap, we need to like really work on this area? Or is it always completely unique?
Well, it's not unique because there's people in every business. So when it comes down to it, it's just how do we listen? How do we have empathy? And how do we support people to be their best selves at work? That's the baseline. But what's interesting is I work right with startups, smaller businesses that are, you know, growing quickly and with quite a younger sort of generational employee base. And then I work right over with construction companies, financial services, ones that have more of a, maybe a male population, more of an old school approach to this stuff. So it's more, the diagnosis can be similar, but it's what part do you start at, but depending on what you've got in place already.
Anything. So what would be the kind of troubles that you would face as a startup?
Yeah, so startups, often there you start really small, right? And you just have a couple of people, you're all at the meeting, it's fine, you're building, it's fast growth, all that sort of thing. And then you start getting to like maybe 100 people, 200 people, you need some more systems and structures in place. Not everyone might be in contact with the CEO or the founder anymore. They now need kind of a chain of managers and people that they trust to look after their people. So already that growth means there's more scope for misunderstanding of policies. They might only be now creating any policies. So they're sort of still making stuff up as they go along. Often there might be one person who's the people manager or head of people or whatever the name they give to it these days, the HR sort of role, who might be like 23 or 25. And now managers with this new awareness of mental health, if something comes up, they might just say, speak to HR, speak to the people manager, and they over that person doesn't have maybe all of these skills to and because what they should be doing in that role is empowering managers to manage their people, not be taking on anything that's a little bit difficult or outside of like task focused stuff. We should be empowering every manager and every leader to have conversations and be open and ask for the opinion of the person about what they most need to help them be productive. And to lead by example in being open and honest. So the best startups are the ones where the CEO talks about their mental health, which immediately gives permission for other people to do the same. And then, of course, there's the detail of, you know, either flexible working or putting in yoga or having education pieces and training, that sort of stuff. But what's really exciting is mostly they're more open-minded to this sort of topic, because millennials are and younger generations are talking about mental health in a bigger way in general.
So do you find that when you go to bigger businesses, then this is more of a problem that they just don't even think about it? They're not like, there's no capacity for it?
Well, it was great because I was just in the States doing a keynote at a behavior health company. And I just stayed at the whole conference so I could ask loads of questions and be like, well, how do you guys view it over here? And the UK is actually ahead of the game, which was very reassuring to me that we're doing a lot more things than maybe other places are, which was great. I guess what the bigger the company or the more old school, the more politics are embedded. If there's been a toxic kind of situation, it's now more deeply ingrained. So it just takes a bit more work to unpick it. Luckily, because of the momentum as far as mental health in the news and the royals and all that sort of thing, more and more companies, if not all companies, are at least asking the questions now of what do we need to put in place? Like they're seeing the benefit, even if they haven't fully bought into the business case, but they see that other companies are doing it. Like Thames Water has won loads of awards around mental health and well-being for their employees. So now other companies are going, ooh, in order for us to have edge, we've got to focus on this as well. But there can just be more ingrained cultures of toxic masculinity, shown a weakness. And there can be real statistics of people being let go for other reasons, but really they're to do with their mental health. So that stuff is going on as well. So we just need to start at a slightly slower pace with those companies, get some training in, start with their managers, and then develop it from there.
Interesting. So how did you get into this whole field to establish yourself as an expert and be able to go into companies to give this training?
Well, overnight success is usually 15 years of work, you know, 10 to 15. That's usually what overnight success looks like. I was speaking at a big panel event for Spotify, for BBC introducing, and my friends were like, you're such a natural. This just comes so easy for you. And I'm like, oh, hell no. I was the shyest kid around and had no education growing up and had to learn everything as an adult, you know, and figure out how to develop as a person, practice, you know, that's what overnight success actually is. But also so I was raised in a religious cult. I grew up in lots of different cultures, India, Brazil, Kenya, Russia, like loads of places. But then we just, you know, they gave us the school of life rather than actual education, right? Which I can now appreciate has given me a real head start in working with people from lots of different companies. But there was a good portion of time there where I was a victim and I resented my past and I resented having kids young and just all the things that just were holding me back, right? Which led me to a place of being suicidal myself and definitely used alcohol as a coping mechanism, which got me into addiction. Let me just tell you, it was dark. But from that place, I kind of have nothing to lose anymore. So when I take risks in business or anything like that, I'm like, I could be dead, literally. So like, what is the worst that could happen? But I think my edge within this marketplace recently has just been about relationship building. So I'll be with a CEO or somebody right at the top and I'll go deep quickly and just go, how do you look after yourself? What are your biggest challenges right now? From a deep place of curiosity about humans. But of course, as an adult, I educated myself. And I think when you're living your truth, one thing just leads to another and you just take the next risk and the next step and it just gets really exciting.
Cool. So you were just really fascinated with sort of mental health because of your own mental health problems. And that's what led you to then help others with theirs.
Yeah. So it was definitely my own mental health. And then I was actually in some of the darkest parts of my life when I was training to be a psychotherapist, which is ironic. There's this deep drive often for us to fix ourselves or to learn, like if we can just understand the science of psychology, then maybe we can figure ourselves out. Right. And
yeah.
I didn't have the big like 10-year vision of doing this or doing that. It was more like, how do I survive? What do I know? I know people. That's the only thing that I know from being raised the way that I was, right? So how do I capitalize on that and make that into some kind of career? That's all I knew. And over time, it developed into sort of different professions that I just got addicted to learning, I think.
So you just took like online courses? You went to university? How did that?
So I studied to be a counselor first. I went one day a week, and this was my one survival day a week where I put my son in nursery. And I was just like, I remember that I was hungover half the time. It was dark. I'd go into the bathroom and just have the sweats because I was drinking so much, and it was bad. But I was still learning and developing. And then I did a master's degree at night while I was working full time and raising my two kids. So anyone who tells me that they don't have time or they're too old or it's just not possible, I'm just like, okay, it is possible. It's hard. And I was not a fun person to live with for those last 6 months. Because I also skipped a degree because my naivete just thought, why would I do a degree and then a master's if there was any way to get around it? So I just applied and didn't think, this is what I always do. I applied, didn't think there was any way. They invited me for an interview. I'm like, there's no way, right? And so I went in and taught whatever. And then I got in and I had no idea how I was going to pay for it either, or even how I was going to manage it. And my now ex-husband would say things to me like, you do know you actually have to do this once you apply, right? But my brain doesn't really think about the bit that I have to do. I'm just like, wouldn't it be great if? And then I just first step and then I go, fuck, I got in, right? Shit, now I've got to figure out how to do the rest, which is, I've now learned, great for being an entrepreneur.
Yeah, we'd like to slightly dig into how you dealt with addiction. So how did you actually quit being an alcoholic exactly?
So rock bottoms are true. It got dark. I went to AA, so Alcoholics Anonymous, at the beginning. I don't go anymore, and I have views on that. AA definitely saved my life, and so I needed it for the first couple of years. And I tried to dissect what were the bits that I needed, you know? Like, if I didn't agree, because I was raised in a cult, right? So I have hyper-cult awareness. So anything that becomes, like, dogmatic, I just go, oh, I just can't. I'm like, let me pick and choose the bits and not find any one truth, because that's where it becomes controlling, or people give up their power. They give up their responsibility to the truth. And that's where it goes a bit wrong, in my opinion and my experience. So AA was, the things were community. So the thing was being fully authentic with somebody so that they saw you. And that sort of took away the shame piece. So learning that instead of going, oh fuck, I did it again and I'm a bad person, let me just drink. And that's the cycle that continues. And let me say, I used alcohol, but you can use like toxic relationships, Netflix, sex, like sugar, like all the things that we're addicted to these days, social media, like mind numbing stuff, right? But if you're able to pick up the phone, and I remember sitting in, there was this big cupboard, and I would sit in it and call somebody up and just go, I need to drink now. And like actually verbalizing how the shittiness that was inside of me just like released it. It was just like, okay, I got it out. I don't actually need to act on it and do the thing. So I was like, okay, so I have to live now a very authentic, honest, truthful life. That's the baseline for me. If I don't, my mental health suffers and I am at risk of going back to an addiction pattern. And it's just enhanced who I am in the world.
Wow.
Yeah, so connection's the key one, really. But I don't go to AA anymore because it started becoming negative for me. I started going and people would just complain about, you know, how hard it was that they faced some difficulty and couldn't have a drink, or they couldn't this and they couldn't that. And it began to feel limiting. And I felt I was leaving feeling like a heaviness. And I was like, fuck that shit. What I need to do is build up a network, like a superpower network of people that just lift me up and that I lift them up.
Yeah, that's fascinating. It sounds like you had to become quite kind of mindful and just sort of observe yourself to see when it was like, this is the moment where I normally have to have a drink. Okay, instead I'm going to call someone and kind of just have a bit more of an overview of yourself.
Absolutely. I used to listen to this 3-minute meditation and it would just be enough of a buffer between me reacting. Because what people don't realize is it's not just the alcohol. You put the alcohol down and now your numbing agent that has gotten you through life, right, isn't there anymore. So it's like you have no skin, like anything can just absolutely destroy you. You have no resilience. Wow. That's what it feels like. And so the buildup process is actually from point of sobriety to probably 1 to 3 years in, where you even build enough of resilience to deal with just normal shit that normal people deal with every day. And so 3-minute mindfulness, I must have just like, I listened to it like a million times because I was in an argument with my husband. Just a minute. I'll be right back, you know, wow. Or just like, interviews, or any time where my cortisol, my adrenaline started building, you know, into a reactive state, like being able to recognize that a few steps before and just bring it down.
Cool. Then, yeah, you raised the topic of the fact that you were raised in a cult, which sounds kind of fascinating. Do you have any insights to that you don't mind sharing? That sounds mental.
Yeah, quite. That's the right use of the word. People think black and white, like they just think it was all evil torture chambers and brainwashing and, you know, whatever. And it wasn't, like, there's all shades of gray, right? So I'm one of five siblings and we traveled to amazing places. Think hippie communes, lots of music, lots of singing, lots of communal kind of living. So people sharing tasks and looking after children together, lots of happiness in that sense. And I guess that's the baseline of how it started. But with all of these things within a generation, and I'm creating a talk actually that maps out the similarities between cults and big organizations. And that as you grow, what the exact same patterns emerge. If you have a toxic person or someone who's power hungry at the top, that's ridiculous how much I know about these places just based on how I live. But then it got dark because it was consistent brainwashing of their literature or their views to things. And it became apparent, which is similar to companies, if you agree with the group and if you play by the rules, you're rewarded, you're loved, you're given freedom, like all these sorts of things. But the second your thinking is separate from the group think, you're ostracized, you're told that you're a bad person, you're pushed away from your sense of belonging. And for us, with not having an education or a family often that was nurtured outside of the group, or for our parents who joined it, you like have nothing if you leave. You don't have any money, you don't have any prospects, you don't, like, you have nothing. And so then it reinforces the idea that they were right all along, that if you leave, you know, God will punish you, or, you know, you'll be seen as a bad person. So the trauma wasn't, I mean, they also believed in free love, and this led to child abuse allegations and all sorts of crazy shit like that, right? Just side point. But the trauma really was, you're like, I could do a whole podcast on that.
Yeah.
And I've been exploring like polyamory and like the new wave of relationship building. And there's an interesting, anyway, dynamic that I have opinions on there. But the real trauma wasn't just what happened in it, because in the group, you had that sense of belonging and safety. But for all of us, especially my generation, the trauma happened afterwards, when you now don't have the tools to live in the real world. You don't have an education. You also, all the trauma that you've suppressed and pushed down and not faced up to suddenly comes to the surface, and you go through this thing of victimization of, you know, what was done to us, anger, like all the stages of grief of, you know. And then from that baseline of brokenness, you can begin to build your life. But some people never do. And the son of the founder ended up putting a bullet in his head, as have many people of my generation. So that's where kind of the roads can go when you've got to cope with this sort of thing.
Yeah. So you were able to keep in touch with like the other people from your cult as they kind of became older and then all tried to leave and things? Or?
I think I definitely took a few years of total isolation. And it's like you need to separate yourself from that way of thinking to even have a chance of building up your own opinions. So there's that side, which makes you feel very alone and like nobody gets you. But then since then, I've definitely reconnected. There's definitely people in my life from back in the day. But once I moved past using a growth mindset from the stuckness of victimization, I then couldn't relate to everyone anymore who wanted to gather around the fireplace, so to speak, and talk about how bad it was and how poor us, you know, for having passed. It just doesn't nurture me anymore. And I separate from some of that.
Well, yeah, on my last podcast, I was talking to a guy that runs a bunch of gyms, and he talks about the victim versus victor mindset. And like people come like, oh, I'm fat because of my genetics and because of like these things. And then they're like, or you can be a victor and be like, you know what? I'm going to smash it. I don't care what my genes say or whatever, anything else. And like, you just take responsibility for things.
And that's propelled you.
Yeah. Because it doesn't really, as in your history is your history, but your life is now and you're still a human. You can still do whatever. You can't just unforget things, but you can learn from the experiences and grow always. I mean, this is easy for someone to say like me. I mean, I wasn't raised in a cult or have any abuse or anything, so.
But what I've realized, though, in the talks that I do is, like, most people have some kind of story. They might have had a father with a temper. They might have been bullied in school. They might have, you know, just the theme of my podcast is understanding those stories. They've had grief. Somebody's died. Like, oh, there's so many things that can allow us to get stuck in a mindset of victimhood. like that's the theme, is how does our body and our minds process hard things that happen? So that made me go, okay, this is more of a universal, yes, my story is this and it's extreme, but how do people get through much worse stuff? There's this whole, I'm somewhere in the middle, and then there's stuff that's much worse that happens to people and they thrive. So what's the science behind that? I guess that's what I'm always curious about.
On the subject of your podcast, so I'm kind of just obviously interested in podcasting in general. So how did you go about like defining what your podcast was going to be? Was that just based on like your own troubles that you overcame? You wanted to just talk to people that have had similar cases?
Kind of. It's so interesting when it starts with a little seed. I started listening to a lot more podcasts and there were people I admired. They had free-flowing interview styles. And I've always, as a kid, I wanted to be a radio host, you know, like old school. Not that I'm even into music. I just wanted to be the Oprah on radio and like, I'm just curious about people. And so I was listening to them and I was working in a job. I wasn't fully an entrepreneur when I started it. And I was like, what is the message that I would have wanted to receive when I was struggling? Like if I was the audience, I think that's where it sort of came from, because I was like, I just needed to know, I needed hope. I needed information and I needed a bit of a challenge as far as my personal responsibility. Not that I knew that I needed those things, but in hindsight, that's what I needed. So I was like, how can I just create a platform where I'm learning, I'm curious about what, like it was really, it had to be driven by my curiosity. Because I think if you're just going, oh, I want to raise my viewers, my audience, and I need to from a, you know, so it starts with a seed and then you'd get the imposter syndrome, like, is anyone going to listen? Is this, does this even matter? And, but with the growth mindset thing, it's like, well, even if no one listens, I'm going to learn from it. And I have this, you know, if you connect with your self-awareness or your gut instinct, I was like, I want to do this. I just want to try it. I remember having a meltdown in my kitchen though, because I'm not super like tech and I was editing, I was doing it all myself. So I'm the one on the weekend going, how to edit on YouTube, you know, how to do GarageBand, you know? And I was like overwhelmed with the tech side, just going, who do I think I am? You know? And I was like, here's going, who's going to even listen? Why the fuck am I putting myself through this? You know? And then I obviously published my first one. And the second conversation I had, I'd learned so much. He'd spent 20 years on his sister's sofa in the heart of drug and alcohol addiction and is now living his best life, which is training to be an accountant. He's got friends. So it was like the contrast between what his life was and is, even though it wasn't like I'm a billionaire and I'm doing all of this. It was like, beautiful, the work that he'd put in place and the impact that he was having in his world around him. But then, as you know, you got to be consistent, you got to be disciplined, you got to put it out. If you commit to a day and a time that you're publishing, I just learned so much. And then it's gone through phases of people listening, lots of feedback, no one listening, no feedback. And but then you also get a bit of a pattern of like, what's the content that's really speaking to people? How can I be better at what I do? So it's always, what can I learn from this situation? And I mean, we're still out there, so it's exciting. And I think we're going to add to it as far as a program to support people with that adversity to advantage theme. Like, how do you use your worst time as your superpower? Like, extent, not just like, oh, how do I accept them and keep going? It's like, no, no. The things that have actually happened to me have actually allowed me to get to an actual, like a totally different platform, a different level of giving back and inspiring in the work that I do than had I not gone through them.
So what would you say were the biggest mistakes that you made in podcasting?
I think when I was just doing audio, because now you can, I've got, done video as well. There were times when it felt like work. I was still working full time. I was, you know, there was, it felt like a lot of work. And then I was, you know, when you start, you just go, I hope somebody's going to want to be interviewed. I have no idea if they will be. And then you're super grateful that they want to be interviewed, but then I'm halfway through and I'm a little bit bored. And so I've got to go, damn, was this part of me? Like how I connected with them and just said yes, because I was like, yes, please, I need someone to interview, you know? Or was it my level of engaging the conversation? So I now do a bit of a priming conversation before we start, which is like to get us connected, to find out what their intention is, like what's the message that they want to put out in the world so that I can like highlight it. And so it's just something in the getting the right guest and my responsibility to make that interview the best that it can be, to give people practical stuff afterwards.
Yeah, definitely. What would you say has been your favorite question to ask people then, besides how they got over things and what they learned? Have you got any like sort of ending questions that's just a bit of fun, or why not?
Well, no, we're not that fun. We're serious. No, we laugh all the time. Of course we do. But I'm very quite organic in my flow of questions, but I like finding out what challenge they're facing now and what routines and habits they put in place to look after themselves now, because there's the great, like, it was shit and now it's perfect. Yay. You know, that story. And I'm like, okay, so you've learned loads of stuff, but I know that that's not how life is, right? So I want to get real about, like, what are your biggest challenges now? Like, both in, like, personally, like, what about you holds you back from actually doing all this stuff, right? And so that brings it into the moment. And then I like, you know, on a good day, what are the routines you put in place? On a shit day, what happens, you know? And just kind of weighing that stuff up. So I just like, how does this apply to our current lives?
Cool. Yeah, I like that. It sounds like a great question to ask on a podcast. So I'll use some instant feedback and lessons for podcasting and ask you, what do you have challenges with at the moment? And what is actually going on in your life that you have to deal with? And how do you deal with it?
Well, so I keep pushing myself out of my comfort zone. So I'm now on some big speaking agencies. I'm doing keynotes where I get paid quite a bit more to speak on a big stage and talk to really important people. And so that's still, sometimes it's great, sometimes it's scary. And I've got to make sure I prime myself, you know, beforehand, do my research, all that. That's a challenge, but it's a good one. It's one that I like to have. I've got two teenagers. So I got a 15 and a 12-year-old. I'm divorced. They live half the time with me, half the time with their dad. So managing the relationship between my ex, his girlfriend, my kids, like all of the emotional support that goes into that is a challenge. But I was very proud that we all spent Christmas together with my ex-husband, his girlfriend, my kids. Like that, I mean, that took about a year and a half's work to really like nurture. Like I took his girlfriend for coffee so that we could connect, which is not easy. Let me tell you. That is not an easy thing, but it's for the big picture. Where do you want to get to? What's the hard stuff you need to do to get you there? Like that's my framework for life, right? And now I'm going to do an online program that I've put off for a while because tech just makes me break out in hives. And so that's exciting. But I'm also, so this is, we were talking about some of my content that's a bit more of my voice and what I feel people need to hear. Like the no bullshit approach to looking after your mind, therapy and coaching, like just to say it like it is. So that's a challenge for me is to just, I think, put my own voice out there in a bigger way that's beyond just the podcast.
Cool. Yeah. So you think you might start like writing books and things?
I actually spoke to a book publisher while I was in the States, which just serendipitously happened. Yeah. I know. So yeah. Yes. Yes. So that will be both a challenge and a win, I think, once it gets out there.
Nice. Coming out 2020.
Yes.
Nice. And how did you go about doing more public speaking? Were you just speaking in general and then some agents contacted you, or did you find agents?
I'm a hustler. I hustle. When I look back, you know, the overnight success actually takes 10 years. I wanted to work with young people, with teenagers. So I started volunteering at a youth center in the heart of South London, Peckham. One day a week, they did not need me at all. I did not fit in. I was not their best star performer. Do you know what I mean? But I just showed up. I showed up and I chatted to the kids and I chatted to the other workers. Like if we think about where we have to start, you just have to show up. I then worked with young offenders. I worked in schools where kids had been kicked out of school. So pupil referral units. And I mean, if you can handle a class like that, where there's, you know, there's weapons and kids are just like losing their shit and you can still stay composed and calm, like corporates, please, a couple guys in suits, please, you know? So, but I didn't know that that's what that was preparing me for that. Right. And then I took every opportunity to speak. So there was a personal development meetup. I'd be like, oh, hey, can I do a 20-minute talk? And just for free, just to show up, figure out my content, figure out my presence, attend lots of talks and observe, you know, what were the things that got people's attention. Like I go to some of these coachy talks. I now know which ones to leave immediately because they're following a framework of psychological manipulation and it fucks me off. I don't know if we're allowed to swear, but I've done it a few times. I can see when they're following a sales formula for their talks and it's not authentic. Anyway, so I think I've just learned by attending, showing up, doing, and I've done talks where I've messed up. Like I've gotten completely red in the face. I've lost my place. I've had to make a joke. I've had to adapt. I've lost the room. All of that stuff has led me.
And then the ground doesn't eat you up and you don't die or anything and it carries on. And
so just keep going. And then I'm very good at finding mentors as well. So if there's someone I admire, I'll be like, oh, I'd love to learn from you. Can I just take you out for lunch? And then I'll just like do the things that they tell me. So I ended up chatting to like a speaker who gets paid like a real lot for speaking at big companies. Took him out for lunch. He gave me his framework. I went and did it. He checked up on me and I said, I did all the things. What's next? He's like, nobody ever does all the things that I tell them to, you know?
People are so impressed when you do as well. They're like, whoa, yeah, shit, must give this person like more useful advice than...
Yeah. And so now we're firm friends and he still offers me advice. But I definitely applied to get onto speaking agencies myself. Once I got on one, it was easier to get on more. And it's a ripple effect.
Nice. So you think it's useful to be on multiple ones? Because as a naive person, you'd think like if you've got one agency booking you, that'd be plenty.
No. So this is what I've learned and what works for me is get onto as many speaking agencies as possible because they're inconsistent and they've all got thousands of speakers and some work for your content better than others. And then the other tip from my mentor was have a personal touch. So if you can go into their office and they can see a bit of what you do or get on the phone, like I talk about mental health. You got to educate them that can be fun and funny and a bit Ruby Wax-ish and, you know, direct and, you know, entertaining and all those sorts of things. They've got to get a sense of your personality to be able to sell what you do to their clients. Yeah. So personal touch, get on as many platforms as possible. And for everyone, I want to shake people sometimes. One rejection does not mean you're on the wrong path. It happens all the time. So I tried and then I didn't hear back. And so I guess that means that I should not be doing it. I'm like, how? If you believe you should do it anyway.
That's cool. That's really useful advice. Okay. Then one thing I like to talk to people about is sort of the future of the industry that they're in. So obviously there's going to be a great no bullshit book coming out soon, but in sort of 5 years time, what do you think the big shifts and changes will be in like the industry of like mental health?
I think there will be legislation for companies, strong advice and recommendations or frameworks of things they need to put in place to look after their people. So in the same way as health and safety has saved lives and has got things in place that you simply have to do in order to have a stamp of approval, be a safe environment, I think a similar thing will happen for mental health, whether it's in the health and safety framework. So for using the health bit more efficiently to think about mental health, not just physical health. I think that's coming and that companies are going to be even more competitive about, you know, getting that stamp of approval. And then the future, if we think about the younger generation and that startup culture moving into being the major companies and the major players, well-being people is going to just move higher and higher up that list in order to, because the younger generation, purpose, fulfillment, all those things are more important to them. Nobody stays in a job and deals with toxic bullshit forever anymore. There's some people. But many people don't. There's more choice to do your own thing or to leave. And there's more of a culture of, you know, I got my experience. I got the thing that I need. If this isn't fitting for my mental and my physical and financial health, I will look for something else or start my own business, right? That's the world we're moving into. So it's going to become even trickier than ever for employers to retain employees. And they've got to put these sorts of benefits and perks and support in place to make people stay. So it's going to be a non-negotiable. But the UK seems to be leading the way over a lot of places. So I see that we will then be showing other countries how to do this well. Those are the changes that I foresee.
Cool. So what are your like habits for mental health that you practice? You know, do you exercise every day? Do you have a bath? What is important for you?
I'm reading The 5 a.m. Club. Have you read Robin Sharma's The 5 a.m. Club?
I've heard of it.
He's like a rock star. So not that everyone needs to wake up at 5 a.m., although I have been testing this out, but his idea of as soon as you wake up having, I think he calls it a victory hour, and it's divided into 20-20-20, so 28 minutes exercise, 20 minutes reflection, goal setting, all of that, and then 20 minutes learning, so reading and watching things that brainwash your mind for good. And so, as I said before, like a one-size-fits-all, but I'm going, okay, what is the value of putting this in place? Any knocks out, there's no technology for the first like 2.5 hours of the day, which is like, I'm not doing that, and no technology in the evening. All the evidence is that top performers, you know, utilizing these sorts of tools perform even better, right? So it's this misnomer that we need to be always on and that we, you know, we just can't sustain high level success if we're not having time to reflect. So I definitely do a morning routine that adapts at different times or depending on my week, but at its baseline, it's three things I'm grateful for, three things I need to do. If I end this day happy that I've achieved, what are the three things and the magic of threes, right? And three ways or characteristics that I want to be. So who do I want to be today? Jotting down those three things. So that's like my fast zone morning routine. And my constant challenge is fitting in exercise and healthy food. Like it's just not automatically on the top of my list. I have addictive tendencies. So sugar is this like quick hit stress reliever. And then my skin breaks out and I have less energy. You know, like I'm constantly in the, I'm doing well. No, I'm not. I'm doing well. No, I'm not. You know, yeah, it's a challenge.
Okay, nice. What would you say is the best advice you've ever been given, or like a favorite quote?
Oh, so the quote that's on my phone is the best revenge is living a good life. And so that got me out of victimhood into like, well, I'll show you. Rather than I'll show you, I'll fuck my life up so bad that you'll feel bad. It was actually flipping it and going, I'm going to live such a good life and do everything that wasn't handed to me as a child and a young person. That'll show you. So yeah, that's still on my phone. And recently, Tom Bilyeu from Impact Theory, I don't know if you see any of his stuff, but he did a keynote where he said, it's all your fault. It's all your fault. And so that just opens up, and rather than making you more depressed, it opens up this possibility that we always have control for our baseline of where we get to now, right? Mm. Rather than, you know, oh, poor me, I can't, you know? No, it's all my fault. If things are happening now, relationship breakdown, or business stuff or anything, it's like the buck stops with me. I am the common denominator. And that just builds a, how can I develop myself in order to tackle those things rather than, oh, they always happen to me, which is one of my.
Yeah, things. Yeah. It's always such a like a alarm bell when someone says that to you and you're like, oh yeah, maybe I need to spend less time with this person.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. So what would you say is the kindest thing anyone has ever done for you?
Well, as much as my ex-husband is my ex-husband, that boy stood by me through the worst of my addiction. And so kindness isn't always one act. It can be the slow, consistent presence of someone through the worst side of you. So I'd say that was kind. And even though he had his own toxic stuff and didn't know how to deal with certain things, I have a lot of gratitude for him being present in that way, which was right after I left the cult and I was a fucking mess. You know, I was not a good person, you know, at all. So I admire that about him.
Nice. So what would you say is your most vivid memory from childhood?
Well, the most vivid one just connects to some of my other family members, but I would just say the most vivid one is someone in my family being punished in front of other people quite harshly and quite frequently, and me not having a voice to stop it or do anything about it. So kind of being the bystander. And I say that because it also propelled me to never not have a voice again, to always fight for justice, because in that moment, I didn't have a voice and I couldn't protect this person. And I wouldn't have anyway. I didn't have the skills or anything, but I definitely felt guilty about that for a long time. Like I should have gone, punish me instead. You know, I should have done that brave, like, I'll take the punishment or something. That's what my brain used to tell me, that I was a coward and I was weak because I didn't do those things, you know. But it's propelled me into being the voice for other people, enabling, empowering people to have a voice. And you can tell I just have opinions coming out of everywhere because I'm just making up for last time. That's what that is.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Thanks for sharing. Okay, is there anything else that I haven't asked you that I should have asked you?
I think we've gone to a lot of places.
Yeah, it's been really good from my side. But there could be lots of good other things that I just sort of, you know, don't know what I don't know.
Well, I don't know what I don't know. And I think there's always a what scares you now or what's the next big push, you know? And I mean, can I flip that? Can I be like, what scares you the most now in moving towards your whatever dreams or visions?
Yeah, I guess I do worry that you get to like 95% there and you kind of have the resistance of like, it's all actually sort of starting to go in the right direction. And then you kind of start to like ignore it a bit because if it's, I don't know, sometimes you feel like you kind of proven to yourself that you can get there, but you actually get a bit like panicked by arriving at the success and things. And then like, other people tell you shouldn't do it and stuff. And so I kind of a bit worried that I might make lots of opportunities for myself and then kind of shut down and sort of do the wrong things. And then I am a bit second guessing because I, you know, I have potential opportunities with other like business things right now that I'm sort of saying no to because I'm like, oh, I want to focus on the podcast, but maybe the podcast becomes like
huge and amazing. And I'll be like, oh, I want to like not focus on the podcast and go focus on like this business idea. And so I do worry that I'll just jump to like another thing too quickly. So that's a problem. Then like a more like existential life worry that I find hard to really appreciate in the moment, which is why I think it's sort of more like a long-term one, is that like personally, when it comes to sort of girlfriends and things, like I've had some great ones, but that was actually all like quite a long time ago. And like, I just sort of any given day, it doesn't really like bother me, you know, I'm pretty happy, content doing my things and just don't really bother to go out and try and find girlfriends every day. It's not like each night I lie awake and like, oh shit, I haven't got a girlfriend. But like, if I get to sort of 90 and I haven't had like a wife, I'll be like a bit annoyed about things. And like, that's like a major thing I should deal with. But it's not really on my agenda to really do stuff about, but I feel like it probably should be, but I can't be asked with Tinder and all these things and doing lots of dating with people that I'm not interested in. I just kind of want to find someone that I am really interested in straight away and have it kind of easy, which is obviously a bit stupid and not how it happens. But yeah, so that's kind of a worry.
Yeah, I get it. I think if we apply the overnight success thing to dating.
Yeah, got to deal with some more rejections and things going wrong. And
yeah, I think all of that inoculates us. I think I learned something from every date I go on, even if it's something about me that went, okay, I could have spotted this in the text phase and not actually met you. Or it's like within the communication loop of even if I'm the one saying, actually, this doesn't work for me. Like, how do I say that? How do I practice my integrity while being truthful? Like, I feel like there's a practice ground in relationships in general that's useful for the workplace, for work colleagues, for just learn like self-development. But I'll go through phases, but in a good phase, I'll go like on 2 dates every 2 weeks. Like the week off that I don't have my kids, like I'll just spend like 30 minutes, invest in it, line something up and show up so that I also keep the skill of showing up. So I'm like fucking amazing at the first 3 months now. and then I'm like, ooh, don't want to be trapped. This doesn't feel right. Bye-bye. There's good learning there. But also sometimes we have to say no, right? In order to stay hyper-focused on the dream.
Well, I don't know. For being a guy, you know, you have to put a lot of work in to be able to go on 2 dates. It's not like I just sort of sign in and go, oh, okay, I'll accept these 2 dates. It's sort of like, okay, I'll work for like a month of like on my phone trying to get these people. So
it's true.
Maybe I should just spend more time like just approaching girls.
Didn't Tim Ferriss did? Oh, Lewis Howes talks about that.
Yeah.
About like for a month, every single day he would
get like 5 girls' numbers or something. And
just to inoculate against rejection. And just like, put yourself out there.
Definitely.
Good practice. Okay.
Nice. Thanks.
Let me know how it goes.
Yeah, sure. Cool. All right. That was, yeah, normally then the final question would be to ask if you got any questions for me, which you guys, you sort of already have done that.
Well, kind of, but I'm curious about the big dream. So you're focusing on the podcast. What's the writing that you're doing?
So the writing's a bit mixed. I just sort of found that I've got so many different things going on in my brain that I really enjoy writing about. So stuff about like future and AI, like psychology, evolution of like your brain and mindsets that I kind of alluded to in this podcast was nice. Then like I did the meditation retreat and there's like a lot of good information about the benefits of meditation and things, but it's not very accessible to normal people, I felt. So I kind of want to write something that like speaks to people a bit better, that they could actually be like, oh, holy shit, I could go for like 10 days and do my own meditation thing, or find ways to actually sort of really get people a bit more interested in that. And because that was actually like a really funny 10 days of my life, like trying to explain it to people, it sounds more like I'm doing a comedy routine, but it's just like the stupid things you realize go on in your brain and like how life is. And so it's actually like a really nice story that I really want to tell and do a good job of, and just learning my craft as a writer and getting better at it. So I just really like working on things and getting better at them and sort of shutting myself off from the world and just working on a skill. So that's kind of how I feel about writing at the moment. So the long-term goal, I guess, is, yeah, having more of an audience that would like listen to the kind of things that I'm creating and being really good at creating and helping them. So it's not like I just want people to listen to me for no reason. I actually want to like be able to help them, which is kind of why I want the audience, if that makes sense.
I'd read that. A 10-day retreats freak the hell out of me.
Yes.
Being alone with my brain that long, I'm like, oh, hell no, without any distraction. But I can imagine it's a massively good skill to get fight or flight.
Yeah, the first few days were so hard, and like signing myself onto it was a bit of like, why the hell am I doing this? Some guy said it was good, and here I am going. What was going on in my brain when I did this? Yeah, after that, it became awesome after the first few days of just sort of quieting your mind a bit. Yeah, just battling with like stupidness. Yeah, you get so many insane insights, and I wish I'd done it when I was like 16 or something instead. And you're like, oh, wow, I could have been so much better at life so much earlier. Because you know, when you sort of you do something really stupid and like a few weeks later, you're like, oh my God, why did I do that? You sort of look back at your whole life and like every day you just think of more and more things where you're like, oh Jesus, I need to apologize to everyone I've ever met. Oh my God.
Good self-reflection. Okay. Maybe one day I'll be brave enough.
Yeah. One day. Well, like, hopefully when I'm reading your book next year, you can be reading my book in
Deal.
Nice. Good plans. Awesome. All right. Thanks very much. We'll keep in touch.
Yes, we will. Take care.
You too. Ta-ra.
Now, thanks so much for Petra being on the podcast and all her personal advice as well. An insane amount of lessons and insights for all of us, I think. Now, next week, I have Ed Reed, the founder and CTO of Graze, on the podcast. Graze is one of the biggest health food startups in the last 10 years, and their healthy snacks can now be found in most stores across the UK and US. We go through how the business started and all the stories of failure and success along the way they had during the crazy rise. We also cover some of his biggest life lessons and what he's done since he sold his shares and his new business, Tiny.co, which is revolutionizing childcare. So if you want to know more about healthy snacks and creating a massive business, stay tuned for next week.
You've just listened to an episode of the Growth Mindset Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe on your preferred app and give me a good rating, as these go a really long way. If you are unable to give good feedback right now, try sharing the show with a friend who will, or just wait for the show to improve. If you have any ideas for the show or you just want to chat, then please reach out to me on Twitter at Sam Harris Tweets, or Instagram at Sam Jam Snaps. Show notes and other links to topics discussed in the episodes are available at the website, growthmindsetpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Give yourself a big hug from me. If you're with a friend, give them a hug as well. And I hope you enjoy your next podcast.